ideal in any way?
I have an example to bring into this debate, because last week, a couple of weeks ago, we had our guests from Kenya and we discussed the issue of climate change, because of course they are going to be feeling the effects of climate change much sooner than we do. And we asked them how it affects their small community. They live in a little place called Mekongi, and they have 4,000 people there. And there were multiple things. There are the ones who are very active in fighting climate change. They are protecting this mangrove forest and really working hard. And then we discussed a lot how, like, the elders in the community feel about these issues. And this thing came up that some of them, for them, these are just, everything's kind of, maybe it's a belief thing that they just believe these things are happening. They don't really think of science in that sense. They live in their own small reality where they have their, they believe that nature will just do as it does, and they don't, for those who don't, like, they live in their own little world where they're going to be completely affected by this change, but then they just believe this is going to happen. And I think, I wonder if this is something that happens in the world in religions. Are these ideas that this is just going to happen to the human race? Because then how do you then have a truth for them if this religion and science type of friction that comes then? But then for us who believe in the science, that this is the truth, or science is truth that's going to happen, then human race, we're going to suffer. Lots of countries will become very difficult to live in those spaces, and it will affect everyone. I have this feeling, I'm just wondering, how do you get this change? Because does it need to happen? If it can't come from above, does it have to happen from below as well, that everyone believes or decides together that we have to do something about this? Then how then when you encounter belief systems and these problems?
I would throw in this, so you said I was speaking about, but sort of science is independent of the beliefs or the scientific truths, and of course reality is what it is. And so you, it's kind of, you can have two kind, at least two differences. You can sort of see it from a so-called raw realist perspective, that okay, if things go even worse and even worse, then we will see it in the world, and things will begin to happen in the small community in Kenya, for example. It might lead to that they can't sort of survive. Mm. And that we can be kind of a disaster. Before that, probably, although there is these kinds of belief also that nature will have its way and so on, okay. But also in the same countries, social upheaval and social unrest is equally common there as in Western world. So at some stage, you will have social unrest. You will think so, sort of. People will have a bad life, and you will have social unrest. And the raw realism is, you wait for that, then things will, of course, begin to happen.
Yeah.
That's sort of a very common thing in human history, of course, it's not the good scenario, of course. But then, of course, what other is, well, some political theorists like David Held, famous for global political theory, as one of the things that he finds very important is this civil society aspect, where we continue from civil society perspective to put pressure on politicians and all and all, that these things are sort of now important to do something about. You don't have to argue about science and climate change and this truth. It could be enough that you say, okay, all people in the world should have clean water, mm-hmm. and you can see this, all of you in all different countries. So let's do something about this. And then you press on with these different kind of things, that poverty will lead to social unrest. So you're in trouble. If you won't have a sort of stability that you need to sort of stay rich and so on, powerful. You will have social upheaval, you will have attempts at revolution. So you can see this happen. So less inequality, more equality, then you can avoid these kind of things. And health thing, this is one of the more important things that we can do. That it doesn't mean that you have sort of from the sort of bottom or from the top, that from the civil society in between, that you begin to put pressure on the politicians all over the world. And then you can, I mean, that's a hope that you can be, it's been successful in the past, so it can be successful again. Of course, you have this risky background that you all are waiting for the climate situation to get worse, and that only when the rich notice that now we can't have our good life anymore, then they will begin to notice. But okay, you can be proactive and say, look, it's coming. we can do something together. We can invent some new ways of organizing things.
Just this is exactly for all of you. Could you use any examples of a success from the past of when? Just an example of how civil society has managed to enact some change through pressure, like.
Well, there's of course a lot of examples from history. I mean, labor movement, civil rights, all of these. Interestingly, one of the examples that Hell is mentioned is the International Criminal Court, which in a way is, it's partly based on initiatives from the UN, but not only, and then it was developed from sort of a civil society perspective into a formal institution, which now is in existence and have some power, at least symbolic power, it can tell. It is part of the global debate. That's a very recent example but there's a lot of these examples, of course.
Yeah, civil society is hugely important for functioning democracy. So, and it's not just like demonstrations and others that is important. It's also, if you think of all the like non-governmental organizations, NGOs, like, you know, the kind of, for example, how Amnesty has been talking about human rights, for example. You know, those are things, or like anti-war movements or like environmental movements. Like, civil society is absolutely crucial, and it has had huge, a lot of like, big societal changes have happened because of civil society actors pushing for them to start off with. And then they've been taken up by politicians, you know, that it's often the change has come from that, in that sense, like grassroots. And it's more powerful that way as well than somebody telling you, like, human beings don't usually want somebody to tell them, this is how you're going to have to think. And so if you're thinking of your community, I think that the key is to have like communicators that are already embedded in that reality, in that society, right? You know, saying, and that's usually how, for example, I think she's called Catherine Hay. I'm very bad with names, but she's like a very influential climate scientist in the United States who's also religious. And she's talking, you know, to religious communities about the importance of taking climate action. And she's a very effective communicator. So, you know, you need to have people who are able to reach different kinds of audiences, you know, like one message doesn't fit all. And then, of course, and if you want to have this community engagement, it's usually much more effective when it's people who are living that reality, and then they are, you know, saying what needs to change and thing, and also telling their peers about like, hey, we are having these problems, you know, like our crops, for example, have been failing, and you know, there's certain things that have to change, for example, in the if you think in our small scale farmers of the kind of farming practices, and then that's the kind of information can be shared, you know, among the farming communities themselves and stuff. So yeah, the civil society is absolutely crucial in these things.
Well, I completely agree. I think there's great points under that there has to be this kind of, what would you say, process of, I would again use the word translation, or kind of like this multivocal process when it comes to, for example, climate politics, that we don't have to think that you can only make climate-friendly politics if you have read all the scientific papers and you understand all the ins and outs of Western kind of technological rationality and blah, 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 so on. So, I mean, it's completely possible to do climate-friendly politics from other perspectives or use other motivations than kind of the hard scientific facts, for example. Of course, they are a very, very strong tool for us at least, but I like, yeah.
And science, of course, in itself is not like value neutral. So I'm not saying it's like this. It's not, science is not like this tomb of truth or something like that, that like we can go and, you know, like, but what difference is science from other like beliefs is also it's self-correcting, right? So, you know, scientists do their thing. They bring in maybe their own values and other things into it. But the other scientists look at it from different perspective. And there's it goes with the scientific method. And then our knowledge increases, you know. So science self-corrects itself. So that's what makes it like closest. It's not like the truth, you know. It keeps evolving all the time. But it's like the closest, I think, with the kind of what human beings have gotten to getting closest to the truth is because of the scientific method. So it's just that self-correcting side that I wanted.
I think the ironic thing is that the far right often use this as an argument against climate science. science is never reaches to truth. Yeah. So actually, they don't have a truth.
Yeah, but that's exactly. But that's a kind of
common misconception we have, right? And this kind of post-truth era and stuff, as if there's no like scientific truth. Of course there is, like, you know, I can, you know, we can go and test gravity there ourselves, you know, like throwing something out of that window, you know, I can believe whatever I want, but that won't change the fact that if I drop something out of that window, it's going to go down, right? It's just not going to start floating about all of a sudden, right? So, I mean, there are like scientific truths and stuff, but then there's a different thing, exactly like Matthias said also, you know, like it doesn't, how is it then like twisted in the conversation and stuff?
What about democracy as a solution to all the issues we have discussed? Is this still the best answer we have, or should it be strengthened or altered in some way, or what are your thoughts on democracy and the issues we have discussed so far?
Well, the democracy, first of all, it's not a simple thing. It's many things at one and the same time. And first of all, we should not sort of reduce our conception of democracy to the kind of Western conception that we are used to, but view it in a broader sense. And one mistake is, of course, reducing democracy to the formal system of elections and governments and parliaments and this kind of thing. That's only one aspect of democracy. And equally important, you can't have a democracy without this civil society aspect that we've already emphasized, that you have people that somehow see that they can communicate with each other and agree on things, disagree on things, and discuss and come to conclusions and have this free process, public process, have free and public discussion on things, and through that involve themselves in things and get engaged. So that's an equally important aspect of democracy. And then a third thing, you have to have the possibility to act, to try to do something, try to change and participate in things. So if you view democracy as this quite loose thing with many aspects, it's indeed an essential, and it's not a purely sort of Western model. Although the name democracy is sort of Greek, so it comes from Greek, but we have all over the world before Greek democracy societies that work in a kind of democratic mode without that concept. So it's been something that's been globally going on for many thousands of years in India and Africa and so on. So it's not a purely Western thing. So when we talk about democracy, then we must sort of avoid reducing it to the model we have and think about it in this wider sense. And also, of course, avoid to just think about, we have a nation-state democracy, which we know very well, we know how it works, and what's the problems, and we know it very well. And not then put it on this sort of the same model on the global level, think, well, it should be something like this, like world government. That's the wrong way, I think. But we must go back to this general idea. How could we have these kind of processes working on a global scale, international scale, and even global scale, that you can have possibilities for people to participate, say their view, and these views have some importance in how you then somewhere makes decisions. So yes, I do think democracy is a very, very, very important thing, because it, of course, the basic claim of democracy is that we are all equal, independent of where we live, in what society, independent of status and how rich and poor we are all sort of have the right to have a good life, to have a life at least. So, but it becomes difficult, because usually if you take a post-colonial perspective, you have this, well, democracy is this Western model that imposes itself. So how can we sort of get out of it and discuss democracy in a way that is not dependent on this Western sort of colonial past and so on? So, yes.
Yeah, because there's, of course, always the concept, and then there's how it's been like practiced in throughout different times. And I think what's beautiful in democracy is also this idea that we all get to have an equal say, you know, that we all get, it's not just we're equal, but we also all get to have a say in how things are done. And that's one of the it's new, it was already done in Athens, right? But this more like participatory democracy that Christian already mentioned, like how do people like these new ways of like having mini publics, or there's been just renewed interest in this among like democratic theorists, and it's been put into practice in many countries, in Finland as well, where you have like these citizen panels on there, some advisory things, and or like participatory budgeting, and also like, and how can it be like, how can democratic decision making be also done more like on local scale, and then how can that be linked to the national, and then like, and can the local be linked straight to the global as well? You know, like, I think human beings are very inventive, so it doesn't mean like we have come up with the best way of doing democracy yet, right? You know, like there's all kinds of ways where we can like make the institutions better. It doesn't have to be that you just vote every 4 years and that's it, you know, and then you're kind of out of it, you know, like how can we actually have these meaningful ways of participating?
Sort of problem, if you will, the problem with democracy, of course, that usually democratic processes are slow.
Mm.
And if you have a situation of climate change, climate crisis, that's of course puts a tension into it, because democracy is usually something. Things change and it doesn't have a name, but things go on very slowly. So I guess there's a kind of tension today between those who think that we must press on for climate issues and forget the democracy. Just do it. And then the worry that if you do that, you will end up in a very inegalitarian society, even totalitarian society that is already dominated by this one task, which, I mean, when you start a task like this, do we know when it has ended? do we have any idea what it mean to have stopped climate change? I don't think anyone could say, okay, now we've done it, now we can go back to the normal. It would be something that would go on forever. We will have this for a long, long time, independently of what's actually happened. Someone could say we still need to do this. So this is a very essential tension now between these prospects sort of going quickly to fix the thing and then democracy as giving everyone a life now.
Yeah, I mean, if we think how democracy can help, I mean, it might, as Christian was saying, there are a lot of people who think it might not be the best help, for example, for the climate crisis. But I'm also thinking about this kind of what are the other alternatives? What, if not democracy, then what? And okay, then some kind of non-democratic system, maybe Chinese authoritarian neoliberalism or something like that. Okay, doesn't sound too good, doesn't fit into my framework of justice. But that's one, of course, like the aspect of justice is one thing. Can we kind of solve these social, ecological problems without like coming up with just solutions to them? I think everyone agrees, more or less, not everyone, but I would like to believe that people agree that we need some kind of like just and legitimate answers to these problems, which can be formulated by democratic kind of procedure. So justice is one aspect, and of course pragmatics is another aspect. I mean, these people who, climate theorists, for example, who propose that we should have some kind of climate dictatorships, maybe technocratic solutions, top-down solutions. I mean, looking at kind of only at Western kind of political history, we know that these kind of authoritarian states are not the most stable ones. And then there's always, of course, this pushback risk that when you start to implement policy top down, you get pushback from the people. And this kind of like pushback from people who feel that they're not being heard, they're not being taken into account, this can produce kind of worsening tendencies. That if people believe that, okay, now the EU is forcing me to use these caps on my bottles, which are like attached to the bottle, so we don't produce more plastic waste, then people get really angry. And this happens, like as you were talking about, this does happen. And of course, when it comes to caps, it's not that serious maybe problem, but if you think about the kind of massive scale of reforms needed to have a more sustainable kind of climate-friendly lifestyle, the kind of economic interventions that need to be made, the kind of energy transitions and so on, then if the caps on the plastic bottles provoke this kind of reaction, then what happens when we have some kind of more centralized technocratic solution which forces people to do very radical changes in their lifestyles, and what kind of like pushback effects are we going to get from that? So that's also one kind of reason why I'm very skeptical to this kind of centralized technocratic solutions to these non-democratic solutions.
I agree that it cannot be like purely technocratic solution at all to climate change, definitely not. I actually argue against that in this book that I just published earlier this year, Taking Responsibility for Climate Change. So the last chapter is exactly about that, the kind of theories like Brennan, who are saying that we should have this more like epistocratic form of governance where the experts are in charge. function, then we can come up with these faster solutions and other things. And it doesn't, of course, mean that. But I do also think there's like different forms of democracy, different forms of maybe good way of leading things, that things aren't very black and white, that we've have to say like it's that, for example, a European Union way of doing things, that that's the only way, you know. But there, at the same time, like in European Union, there has been successes in things of like climate laws and other things. So, you know, European Union is one of the leaders in terms of that kind of legislation and has put a lot of things through the technocratic means and things. Also like China, it's really leading in development in solar and wind power. You know, it's really way ahead of competitors. They really invested a lot of money, like absolutely like the number one in the world in terms of green technology. Of course, they also have a lot of coal, but I mean, they really put in a lot of effort on that as well. And I think we just need, I would say that we just need action from all corners and stuff. I personally am, I think I'm more optimistic about democracy than most. And I think it's actually like, it's when there's not all these things messing up the debate and people actually are listening and there's more, a bit more respect there. You know, it's like often people are more, they can be, I think politicians and other people in power tend to also underestimate people. So I give one example in the book from the Irish Citizen Assembly. So they were gathered from Irish people, and it was like directly linked, like 99 people, and they had facilitators. They were discussing different issues over different weekends, and then that was like linking directly to the parliament. So this, it was like linked to the process, but they were looking at different kind of issues. Climate change was just one of them. And before that, they were thinking like that there's just going to be too much pushback to have a more ambitious climate laws in Ireland. And at this point, they had one of the least ambitious climate laws in Europe. But then the Citizen Assembly, they had very different kinds of views. They actually wanted to push for more. They were kind of surprised at what was coming out of it. And it actually became a law then in like 2019. So this had a real life impact, and it came through like the participatory processes of the citizens. Or another example is, you know, like people can, even if they get direct vote, they can, things like in Ecuador, they voted to save the rainforest from further drilling of oil just this autumn. And so, you know, I think there is a lot of, I think people are first of all a lot smarter than some of these theories give people credit for. I think they're much more worried about climate change because they realize that it's going to affect all of us. And, you know, if you're worried about your own well-being, the well-being of your children or grandchildren, you know, this, you know, it's already impacting our lives, you know, or anything. Like, even for self-interested reasons, you should care about climate change. I think most people just feel like there's nothing they can do, this kind of sense of helplessness, or this kind of more like, I don't think it's like if you're actually giving choices that they're not willing to do things. It's just people don't like being told from somebody else, like, hey, this is what you're going to do, especially if they can't link it to like direct results, if it just seems like something small and petty or meaningless or something. But we absolutely need level, like big state level action though when it comes to things like infrastructure. But I don't think anybody in Finland is like crying over the fact that we have so much wind power now, you know? That is something that happened much faster than anybody predicted or projected, you know, like 10 years ago. Like that revolution happened quite quickly. But, you know, that's a combination of state policies and independent, you know, for-profit actors putting, there's this lot of, it's never in society, nothing is very simple. You know, there's a lot of actors pushing for it, maybe also individual consumers. You know, you see like all these power companies these days trying to push for their greener electricity products and stuff. Stuff that wasn't happening at all 20 years ago, right? So sometimes it's also easy to lose track of how much has already changed. And it's not like this was a painful process for Finland. But yet, like, we are so much cleaner now, like our energy production. But you need this like action from different powerful actors, but absolutely like individuals can be supporting and pushing for that from different corners. So it really is this like all hands on deck approach, I think.
One thought that actually came up is that we've discussed the UN, we've discussed states and individuals, but we actually haven't really talked so much about the other actors, which are these multinational corporations, these giant global companies who are responsible for giant emissions. And like, how do we then Is it like, for example, the EU has come up with legislation so that you can only operate in the EU if you abide to our laws, etc. But then is there other ways that, like other power that can come from individuals when it comes to like a big corporation? Because then you'll say, oh, well, it doesn't matter what I do because they're just going to pollute anyway. But then is there maybe in this kind of neoliberal sense, then what about consumer? Like if we reduce ourselves to kind of consumers and our choices, then if a giant amount stop buying these products, then is that a way to actually?
Yeah, well, of course, consumers have power as well. It's not at the level of state power at all. But, you know, like one of the very effective things is like consumers, for example, demanding legislation, right? You know, so, and you can do this through this, a lot of effective NGOs who have really sophisticated campaigns about different kinds of things that are wrong with our policies and how they would be. And they have great ideas of how to make them better as well. So I think one of the things as an individual consumer, I would first like start seeing if I can like participate or donate or something, take like part in somehow in one of these NGOs actions who are like pushing for a fairer world and stuff. So I think they're always there, you know, between those. You don't have to be alone and do things on your own, you know. I think first thing is just to find like-minded people who are already doing it and like join forces with them and stuff. But yeah, so I mean, legislation definitely the most effective way. But often the pressure comes from public opinion and other things. How to change that? That's very complex, you know. But at the end, we can see that there's certain things that we can see that at least they have to, many companies now, for example, pretend to at least give like green credentials, right? So the greenwashing is a real problem, but at least they feel enough social pressure that they have to pretend they are doing something. Or my favorite is always like working towards greener future. And then it's like, when you're looking at what are they actually doing now? Not much, but they're working towards it and they plan to do something in 5 years time. It's like, great, let's advertise that, not, you know? And they should also be, I think, actually legislation against like kind of greenwashing, like think that they're very harmful. But at the same time, you can see that there is this like norm that there's certain things that are being that they feel the social pressure to highlight certain aspects and hide others, you know? So that's already progress in a sense, but doesn't necessarily is that effective as we can see. But then there's also maybe there's like new products that are being offered, you know, greener things. Maybe you can like, you can do effective things like change, you know, like when you're choosing, for example, your electricity provider, you pay that tiny bit extra to show your support for those greener options. It's those kinds of things that build the pressure. But and then maybe tell your friends and family about it, or like offer like vegetarian alternatives at your graduation party or something for people, you know, like make it more like that these greener options become more mainstream, become like normalized, you know, people become aware of it. You can do these things without like starting to blame people and like make them feel bad about it. Like a lot of our consumption decisions feel like overly personal and they shouldn't, but then, you know, that's also something that you can feel like very, very sensitive if somebody's trying to make us feel bad about what we're doing. And, you know, like that's usually not very effective. But again, if you're talking with your, with other people, like about the kind of consumption practices, if you like, and they don't have to be about just buying stuff. They can also be, so one of the examples I give in the book is that, for example, like if you're like, I am not a golfer myself, but say that you're like a golf enthusiast, that that's for something maybe in your local golf club, you could say like, if it's a dry summer, let's not water the lawns, you know, because you can still do golf and non-green lawns, you know, but that still has, we have to preserve water and other things. These are some of the things, and we have much more drier summers coming up with climate change as well. So, you know, maybe you can like impact again on those, all those different kinds of kind of unorganized groups. You can kind of affect the kind of values of how things are done within them. Or maybe like in their workplace, what kind of like practices they have in terms of like travel, or again, what's offered in different events and things like that. So think of like those kinds of consumption more like in the groups that you're part of, rather than just only your own individual consumption choices.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah, good points. Well, when it comes to really large corporations, Well, two routes. You can try, of course, to implement restrictions on them on a global level. Would that be possible? I don't know. That's not something that is in existence through legislation that you sort of really put limits to their growth and so on. And that's what many are saying now, sort of the only way you have to regulate capitalism in a way that they are less harmful. And that's perhaps not very realistic today. More realistic, I don't know if I believe it is, but in a way, of course, these large corporations are also the avant-garde, and they want to stay on in the future. They want to stay powerful and rich. So if they are given sort of incentives to rather go not go that direction, but this direction, then it's, of course, this is a sort of standard way of having this green growth thinking that you... They have incentives to change their policy. Oil is not that. These oil companies, they wouldn't care about oil unless they were sort of giving them a lot of money. So they all, but if it's not, then they will move somewhere else and try to have an energy. That's, of course, perhaps the more realistic, but I don't know. Yeah.
Well, great points. But I'm also thinking about this like issue of big corporations and as Christian mentioned, the C word, capitalism. I mean, it is by its kind of economic. I mean, what big corporations are doing is that they're trying to get profits. And how do we get profits? By extracting a kind of either like labor time or resources from people and areas that are most vulnerable and so on. I mean, there is also this kind of capitalist logic side to how the big corporations are operating. And now I don't like, as Sade was talking well about this, that we shouldn't kind of make, it's complex, these are complex issues and I don't think they are settled by just saying that, okay, capitalist structure needs to change. But of course, there is this kind of aspect that as long as our kind of economic rationality remains wedded to this thinking about like profits and infinite growth and so on, then these big corporations will act as they do. They will find the loopholes to extract as much value from vulnerable places and people as possible. I mean, that's just what big corporations do in the kind of structural field. Of the economic system we have. So, I mean, I think that's also something you at least have to count in when you're also thinking about this kind of who responsibilities maybe on this. And I was thinking, Sade, you were talking about this, that we shouldn't make people feel bad when we don't want to ascribe that kind of accountability to people. And maybe this was not what you were saying, but you mentioned.
Yeah, I was saying that.
No, sorry. But I mean, that's an interesting point. I was thinking about this social philosopher, Iris Marion Young, who has this theory about structural inequalities. And what she does is that she looks at the kind of habits of acting and consuming and so on. I mean, these can all be seen as structures, the habituated ways we engage with each other and the world. And then she looks at inequalities in structures and asks, how do we keep people accountable for these things, for these immensely complex, habituated things, which no one is kind of accountable for by themselves. I'm not accountable for capitalism, even if I buy things on the capitalist market. It is a big structure. And Young's solution is this kind of collective political accountability.
Forward-looking
accountability. That, okay, let's not look backward. Let's look forwards. Let's keep the kind of assigning of blame and focus on going forward and what to do in that case. And I mean, this is one strategy which we, of course, can, I think, use when it comes to if we don't want to go around and play the blame game or something like that. We can, of course, take this more future-oriented accountability, kind of collective accountability process. But what would this look like in practice? I don't know. But this is just something I was thinking about when you were speaking. So
Well, I think one thought that I mentioned this in one of the emails, because this is just because my research background is rooted in critical theory, and I read a lot of Michel Foucault, and he of course has this thing of how we are all just kind of, everything is this neoliberal thing that we can't escape, and it all comes down to the market. But I believe one philosopher or researcher, Lois Monet, then she kind of reinterprets some of his work where he wrote about homosexuality and the idea of cultural change and how norms can change. So a little bit like Sadet just kind of explained, that if we can get these things, for example, some of these ideas can become, that they happen so many times that they start to normalize and become accepted. So we have many examples in history. Recycling, the fact that what a crazy idea that probably was, and everyone thought it was stupid, and now you have legislation that demands that recycle certain things. Homosexuality has become very accepted, is now like considered a human right in some context. But then, because I think there is this thing that lots of people will then just say, oh, capitalism, all that, there's nothing to change. But then we do have these kind of, this cultural change, and history is filled with cultural change. 100 years ago, society, Finnish society was very different than it is now. So like just this type of thinking of how, what type of cultural change could happen, do you believe that there's like something could happen in the next 50 years that could, do you think your own visions of the future in 50 years then, do you have any feelings like that? Is there some kind of movement that's strong at the moment that you think that it could come bigger? For example, the anti-climate, those on the behalf of climate measures.
Big question. but my first reaction is yes, things will change, we've seen so many rapid changes in the last 3 or 4 decades that nobody could believe that these things would happen even. So surely there will be changes and new things coming along in the next 50 years. Something similar to recycling on a larger scale that would sort of help. But nothing comes to mind. We will probably have airplanes in the future that are not polluting. And capitalism is getting into that because they know that if the airplane, you must have those kind of airplanes in the future. So that's sort of an incentive for the big corporations also. But that's of course not the kind of thing you are. But do you? Yeah, I can't come now to think about.
Yeah, I think the only certain thing is that there will be a lot of change, because change is the only certain thing in society, right? I agree that there's been lots of very rapid change in the recent decades, even in the recent years, you know. So I mean, and there's lots of these big level things like climate change or inequality or other things that are going to also force those changes to come much faster, you know, like that. Yeah, we're definitely in a period of rapid changes. In terms of what will happen, I think even if I have the crystal ball, that wouldn't work, because like the future is not yet there. That depends on what we're going to do now. So I don't know. I don't know which way we're going to go. I know things going better or worse, or they're definitely going to be different. But what I know for certain is up to us, you know, and us collectively together. So I think what we're desperately in need of is more of these visions of a better future. What we have at the moment is just lots of dread and like anxiety and stress about where the world is at the moment. But we seem to be lacking there's very little of this leadership with a proper vision, right? You know, we're really like, and that's what kind of, and that doesn't have to come from politicians, and can also come from like art, you know, literature, from different kind of different kinds of ways. But we're kind of like, at the moment it seems like we're in this space where we kind of just kind of realize how bad things are, and then we're kind of almost a bit immobilized in this horror, you know, at the moment. But I am optimistic in that I think they will start, people are creative, and I think it's good. It shows that people, When I first started doing the research on climate change, like that was about like 14 years ago now and stuff. Like a lot of people said to me in the start was kind of like, oh yeah, doing that, but I don't really want to hear about it. Sounds like depressing or something like that, right? Or like, oh no, oh, before that, when I was working in like corporate social responsibility stuff, people were like, oh, don't tell me anything bad. You know, I don't want to know. You know, there's a lot of this attitude going on because things were like maybe on the whole, like there's always been lots of problems in the world and in societies, but people, it was still a more kind of optimistic general tone to the world, you know. But I think it's actually in that sense that gives me optimism that now when people are more kind of aware in general of, and there's a lot of discussions about, and a lot of other things that have happened also, like things like, for example, social media, it has brought also a lot of other things like Me Too or Black Lives Matter and all these other things that have actually, yeah, originated in the States, but have also come even to places like Finland. You know, people, I think what you can see that people do care. It's not like people are indifferent to these things. That would be one possible thing, that people just don't care, that they're just so selfish. I don't believe that. Well, we all are selfish to a degree, but I think like what it shows is like people care, right? And I think that's what the optimistic thing about it is, just now we need like kind of more visions of going forward. And I don't think it needs to come from, and it shouldn't come from one or two people, certainly probably not from philosophers, I don't know, but we can be contributing to it. But you know, that's something that we have to kind of visualize this thing together, and it can start from like small steps as well, of small things that you can change in your life and how to make those things better. And then sometimes like people have this tendency of copycatting things that work, right? So good ideas and good like ways of working, they, you know, they tend to start getting picked up by other people. So I don't think we should ever underestimate how much just like doing small changes in your community, for example, could inspire changes in the bigger scale. We just don't know. So I think it's just important that we kind of don't give up hope, because then there is no hope. If we give up now, then yeah, that's it then. I don't think we should do that. But I think there's so much potential there, though. There's all this, like, even there's just so many opportunities also, if you think of the green transitioning. You know, say that in 50 years' time, we have it all fixed. Like, we have, like, really great, fully green power. We can have, like, potential endless energy sources if we really, like, put, like, solar, for example, into proper use, or the high-altitude wind, you know, that we don't really use at the moment. Like, you know, there's just lots of, like, potential there. And then what could we do then? And if we fix, for example, inequality as well, you know, what could a society with limitless energy, which is green and more equal, say like education, like say that all the women and girls around the world, for example, have all gotten education as well, and then we all have a say, and all this potential, or like from different countries, that people in general with any country, so this is totally utopian, but let's say that from any country, you could like rise to the top of your field, right? So I mean, just imagine that just the potential of humankind that would be tapped at that point, how much better like solutions would be keep coming, because we would actually use the whole globe, not just this in this unequal, unfair way. We would actually use human resources and the natural resources in a saner way. And the stuff we could do then, you know, I think the possibilities are like endless or limitless. It's just that we need to get started on the right path, and at the moment it just seems a bit directionless.
Yeah, I mean, very commendable also vision. I agree.
But, I agree also.
But yeah, I mean, I'm also optimistically bent in these things, and my like, and the reason for my optimism is maybe more that there's a lot of stuff happening. I mean, there's a lot of struggles. There's a lot of mobilization. They may be not under the same umbrella. There's a lot of, from different corners, family struggles for human rights and climate, more like climate activist things, anti-colonial struggles, workerist struggles against capital and so on. All kinds of different projects. I mean, what is, and this is to hook on Sade's point about not having, that it all kind of feels a bit directionless. And by kind of reference to our earlier discussion about universal values, I think it's interesting to think about the potentials to kind of political universalization in these kind of varied struggles we are witnessing today? And I mean, do they have, and could they have, a kind of potential to find common ground? And what would be the kind of political inscriptions, symbols, so on, around which to rally if we want some kind of more large scale mobilization? Then we should be on the lookout, right, for these kind of points of contact or convergences between different movements at different important points. I mean, if you think about the kind of European history, then the labor movement as a struggle against capital, for example, had this inbuilt universalizing logic, right? It was the Marxist philosophy about the universalization of the labor struggle as a basis for political action. So it came, the labor struggle came with this kind of universalizable kind of ideological basis, right? So what I'm like interested in looking out for or kind of analyzing is this going forward, that is this kind of possible basis or points of convergence where you might, these kind of movements or struggles which are already happening might also kind of find common ground in this.
Okay, thank you very much. It's really interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And giving us this opportunity to play. It was really interesting. Good.
I think I got some positive thoughts to take home with me. So it's
absolutely. Yeah.
Have to come
many
to
new
again.
Ideas. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please visit our website and follow us on social media. All of this information is available in the description of this podcast. Once again, thank you. Until next time.